This is Joe.
And this is Nat, and you're listening to the Getting Better with Age podcast, the show that helps you navigate midlife challenges and turn them into opportunities to grow and evolve into a happier, healthier, and more empowered you.
And remember, getting older doesn't mean that the best years have to be behind you. We believe, like a fine wine, you and your life can get better with age, and we're here to show you exactly how to do that.
So grab a glass of vino, kick off your shoes, and join us in discovering how to make the next chapter of your life the best one yet.
Hello, everyone. It's Joe.
And Nat.
And welcome back to another episode of Getting Better with Age. To say I am excited about this episode would be a huge understatement. We have a guest today who is just phenomenal. We had the opportunity to connect about a week ago, and he's written a book, and he's here to not just talk about his book, but talk about the message, which is ultimately how you can die happy. For those of you who've been listening, you know I say all the time.
Yes.
My goal in life is to what?
When he gets to the end of his road, he wants to die with a smile on his face and a full and grateful heart.
Right. And it's like, if I can do that, I know I've lived a blessed life. And this is a man who's written a book on exactly how to do that.
Yeah.
So I am super stoked, and you're going to love this. So let me tell you a little bit about him. His name is Martin O'Toole, and Martin is a man on the mend, a recovered high-functioning alcoholic ad man with a tempestuous past life of spilt milk under burnt bridges. Having been talked out of a suicide attempt by his beagle, this rock-bottom moment launched a phenomenal journey of self-healing and personal transformation. Through his intense, and we're going to see intense experiences with depression and the pointless pursuance of success, Martin uncovered the alchemy of everlasting happiness, what he calls the anatomy of happy. Understanding the depths of depression and contrasting heights of delight, compelled to share his story, he started the How to Die Happy podcast and has written an amazing book called How to Die Happy. And at the end of this, you're going to have an opportunity. I just finished this about 2 days ago. And I can tell you that this should be mandatory reading for every adolescent going into adulthood, because it's like in here are the things that you can actually do to live a happy life. And as we said, die with a smile on your face and a full and grateful heart. For that being said, Martin, it is our honor and privilege, and welcome to our podcast.
Yes, welcome. We're so excited to have you. And when Joe told me your story, I was absolutely fascinated. So why don't you give our listeners a little insight?
Well, it's great to be on the show, first and foremost. Thanks for that incredible introduction, Joe. I hope I can live up to it.
You have no choice now, brother.
The train is leaving the station. Hop on board. Yeah, I mean, well, obviously, as you've alluded, my life on Earth has been an adventure. I think the first chapter in the book actually is called A Life of 10 Men, and I would regularly boast to people in my party days while I was the center of attention, telling the stories with a significant amount of alcohol and drugs present. That I'd lived the life of 10 men, and there were many a drama. But then back in those days, I didn't see life through the lens I use now. So it was for me, I never had a comprehension of wanting to live long. I thought I was happy, but I actually was distinctly depressed. And I had an addiction also to drama and suffering. And so it was later through this incredible process over the last few years, which I suppose you could liken to a rebirthing. Well, you would call it a rebirthing. Certainly I had a near-death experience as part of that process. I now see life as an incredible gift. Moreover, I see trauma as a gift. Which may well confuse people. It does often when I say thank you for the gift of trauma. Why would we thank anybody for trauma? And that's because I see the lessons in it now. So I suppose from where I'm sitting now, And I hasten to add, I'm no enlightened guru or PhD. I am just a man on the mend, but I have some tools now and have some experiences in my pocket that enable me to reframe what happens. You know, people say what life throws at you. I never think of it in those terms anymore. Life doesn't throw anything at you. Things just happen. Events occur. So the big mission we have, I believe, in what the Buddhists call samsara, this existence of life, birth, sorry, birth, life, suffering, death, and rebirth, is to be able to see an event as an event. And how we then interpret that event is what defines us.
You know, there's so much gold in there, but I think we just kind of glossed over it, because what I hope our listeners to get is, because when I read your book, I was like, if this man can overcome all of this and be in a place where he is living a life of bliss and being truly at peace, again, that doesn't mean that you don't have your moments. And that's one of the things I admire listening to your podcast with you and Jules. You're just like, you know, the other day I was having a shit fit, and I'm like, oh, great. You mean you can be enlightened and still have shit fits? Because I get those all the time. But I think being honest and telling people, like, just really, like, your journey, you know, the things that you went through, like, you know, you talk about, you know, doing cocaine and being addicted to drugs and alcohol and, you know, having an affair. And again, we're not glamorizing that, but just the fact that, you know what, hey, I'm human. I went through this really dark place. Even, you know, you talked about, you know, in your book, you talk about being on the verge of suicide, sitting on your bed with a loaded gun ready to end your life. Mm-hmm. And so if you can just, like, again, not to glamorize, but just really give some people some insight into that life that you were living. Mm-hmm. And because I think that's most of us, we chase happiness outside, and then we get it and we realize, well, wait a minute, something's missing. So again, not to elaborate, but if you can just give some people an understanding of where you've really been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. Well, to try and condense it all, I grew up in an alcoholic household, and so I grew up surrounded by a great deal of trauma. And fortunately for me, I was able, through using fight, flight, or freeze and survival modes, I was able to create some rather complex coping mechanisms. Mm-hmm. That is to say, many people would grow up in that kind of environment and be depressed and suicidal and perhaps end it all significantly earlier. But that's not what I did. It's not what my brothers did. We learned coping mechanisms. So now, they weren't healthy coping mechanisms, I hasten to add, because they often are not, especially when you are not taking advice from anyone else other than yourself. After all, if you're mentally ill, you really ought not to be taking advice from yourself, right? But of course, we do, most of us, when we're mentally ill, because one of the things we often do is self-isolate. So I flew headlong into a life where I knew I didn't want any of that. That is to say, the family life. I wanted to, so I decided the best way to avoid that was to make a lot of money, to be successful in business. So I went out and I pursued happiness under every rock, in every nook, in every cranny. And I was fortunate to be successful. And my success, that's a funny word, isn't it? Because these days I don't view financial gain or a company or a status or anything like that to be success. But of course, back in those days, it was everything. But that was also fleeting, because being an addict, an alcoholic, money tends to run through one's fingers like sand. The more you make, the more you consume. The only difference is the size and grandeur of the parties. You know, when you find yourself, I remember getting to the point where I was perhaps spending a couple of £1,000 a night. And I don't say that with any pride, because I've now experienced the other side of wealth, and that is none. You know, I've had financial abundance and zero, almost zero money. So I've learned that lesson. I had to learn that lesson. But it was an incredible journey of continually banging my head against walls. I never feared change. That was something I was fortunate enough to have about me. Perhaps it was due to growing up in an ever-changing environment where one could only survive by being able to duck and bob and weave through all of the madness that was occurring. So, and of course, I would make more messes as I grew older. I had a sex addiction as well, so I caused all sorts of problems with many, many women, all in the pursuit of happiness. And as a result, I was often running away from things rather than running toward things. I think people often said, "Oh, well, he's off again. He's a trailblazer. He always lands on his feet." No, I was running away. There was nothing, healthy or successful about the way I went about doing things. So yeah, there were supercars, there were fancy houses and fancy holidays, and you know, a lot of money sloshing about, and but there's nothing to glamorize about it whatsoever, actually, in my experience. And I'm not actually just talking about my own personal experience now, having been surrounded by people also doing very well for themselves, and seeing, looking into their eyes, and with hindsight now I can see they were unhappy too. So one part of the message of my book, yes, is not to sound like some hippie who's saying, right, let's all check out of the matrix and, right, you know, let's start a commune, although that's not a bad idea. what I'm keen to say is, listen to Rumi. And Rumi, who was a mystic poet and a Sufi mystic and poet, he said, perhaps you're searching among the branches for what may only be found in the roots.
Love that.
Which is probably a good summary for that mad story.
I love that, because what I'm hearing is someone who is always searching out there. You were running, but running for something that's going to, oh, this will make me happy, or this right. will make, Let's and the more you got, thing. The more you searched, because it never happened. So also you got to the point. And so I've had two times in my life where I didn't want to be here. Like emotionally, I was in so much pain where it's like, I could truly understand someone who would want to take their life. There was that little part in me that didn't want to do it, but I could understand, and I truly didn't want to be here. So what was going on for you? Because here you had everything, but then you talked about in the book of, I want to check out. What led you to that moment?
Well, it was a culmination of things. I was deeply unhappy with my ability to relate to women, and in that realization, actually, to other people. You know, one of the things a narcissist never knows is that they're a narcissist. And I was, which causes some problems for those around the narcissist, and of course problems for the narcissist. I was fortunate enough to realize my narcissism, which is a bigger story, but I was filled with guilt and shame, and I felt as though I'd caused so many broken hearts and minds. You use the line spilt milk under burnt bridges, which is something I use in the book, obviously. There was so much spilt milk under so many burnt bridges that I couldn't see a way back. I couldn't see a way back to repair all of this damage. Moreover, I was extremely miserable in my career. I was obviously drunk as well. At that time, I was high and incredibly drunk. At the time, I almost killed myself. But also, I was under investigation for tax evasion, money laundering, and fraud at the time, and quite a serious criminal investigation, for which I was never charged, incidentally. But the pressure compounded on top of the misery and the shame and guilt just got too much one night. And so I cleaned the gun before I knew it. I was loading the gun. It was a double barrel shotgun. And I was literally sitting there with it pointed at my head, which for any gun owner, you know, we never do that You know, we never ever point a loaded gun anywhere. We never point a gun anywhere. We just assume it's loaded, right? So gun safety is obviously paramount. So for me to know, A, I was pointing the bang stick end of the shotgun at my face was very counterintuitive, but B, I knew it was loaded. So yeah, I mean, I can't tell you any more other than when you get to that level of depression, you are lost in a very deep and torrid washing machine, like a vortex of misery, shame, guilt, and you cannot see a way of climbing out of it. Anyway, I'm still here. So because my beagle talked me out of it, she sort of kicked the door open and sat in the light. I was sitting in a very dark room. She sat in the light, you know, as the door opened, and she just looked up at me. And as I say in the book, I don't know whether or not it was a don't do it or what will I have for dinner, who will feed me. But either way, there was a moment when I just sort of looked at her and she looked at me and, you know, that was it. Yeah, you're right. And I, you know, I broke the barrel. I threw the cartridges on the floor. I put the gun down. And I just, you know, I just started sobbing. And that was a moment. That was a real moment. Telling the story gives me the goosebumps now, because we just, choice is such an incredible superpower that we all have. And yet we underestimate it at every turn. We can, the choices that we make, the things that we say and do at any time can have a profound effect on our life. Granted, this is a very extreme choice, end it or carry on. But nevertheless, the point remains pertinent, because had I taken myself out then, I would have missed the most incredible transitional journey, which fills my heart with gratitude now, just speaking to you. And I would have put an ending to an awesome set of new chapters to this story. And I don't know where it's going next. I mean, that's the incredible thing about life, isn't it? You really do not know what's going to happen next. But if you can embrace the fact that you don't know, and you can embrace the fact that it is ever changing, and also comprehend the fact that everything in this universe is subject to the laws of impermanence, including one's happiness, then paradoxically, you can remain happy.
Yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, for the people listening, when you were in that moment, you said, and your dog came in and, you know, you were crying, you just started sobbing. And, you know, once that moment was over and you kind of got back to, I guess, reality, I want to say, how did you know what the next step was going to be? Because I think a lot of people would ask, like, how do I even know what to do next?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the God's honest truth is I didn't. No, actually, I was still, that was around 2015, I think. The timeline is a bit hazy because I was using and drinking incredibly and a lot. So it did take me another almost four years of co-created calamity and self-suffering to finally hit rock bottom. It's funny, I was talking to somebody about this yesterday and they said, what was your rock bottom moment? And they assumed it was the night I nearly killed myself. It actually wasn't the rock bottom moment. Yeah, I know, right? The rock bottom moment was after a ridiculous drinking spree that lasted a whole day and night, which was, I was on my way from the north of England up to Glasgow in Scotland, in the UK. And I got so blind drunk on the train with a colleague, and then hit the town. I don't remember any of this. And then ultimately woke up in my hotel room the following morning in absolute agony. And the hotel room was smashed to bits. And I sort of looked around and there were dents in the wall and my laptop computer was in pieces. And I was due to give a workshop. I had a creative agency. I was a high functioning, as you said at the beginning. High functioning alcoholic. Nobody quite knew how high functioning I was. I was doing this brand workshop for a mortgage company, a very, very big company actually in the UK, with about 10, 10 of their people and the deputy CEO. And here I am up in agony. So I move and my knee is absolutely killing me. And I sort of look around and I start to piece it together. And essentially what had happened was I finally got into the room. I was drunk out of my mind. I was drinking, pouring water at myself, spilt it everywhere on a laminate floor, slipped and fell badly, twisting my knee. And I tore the meniscus in my knee. And as a result of quite clearly being so angry with myself, I then smashed my room up using the computer I was supposed to do the presentation with. Anyway, I limped down to breakfast with the colleague who immediately told me, "You were the most drunk person in Glasgow last night," which is saying something for Glasgow because they like a drinking. And I limped onto the session. I lied to everybody, because I was very good at that in those days, and got through the session actually, and ended up doing a phenomenal job for the client. And that's another sad thing about this whole thing. I had this ability to create subterfuge very quickly, to put on various masks for various people. So you would get this version of me, you would get that version of me. And in spite of the fact that I'd torn the meniscus in my knee, and for any medical people listening, that's really painful stuff, especially when you choose to walk a mile through the town to do the session because you need to sober up, because I was still drunk, and then give a presentation and keep people engaged for what was a 4 to 5 hour session. Well, that's high functioning. But therein lies the problem, because, of course, if we can get through that sort of behavior and still muddle through, then we're normalizing what to many other people would be classed as literal insanity. So that was actually the rock bottom, because I got home and I had a ski holiday booked with my partner at the time, and we were going skiing 2 weeks later. Of course, my knee was absolutely destroyed, so I tried to snowboard. I couldn't do it, so I spent the whole holiday drinking. Just drinking Austrian beer. She was off on the slopes. I would wait for her in the bar, drinking 10 pints of incredibly strong lager and Jägermeisters and all of that. We had several fallouts because, of course, I was blind drunk. She was drunk as well. We were very unhealthy for one another in that regard. She had her own issues with substances. And on the last day, she came down and I was miserable as sin. And I remember just sipping this, emptying this pint glass. And I put the pint glass down and I said, "That's the last drink I'm ever going to drink." And of course she said, "Yeah, right." And, and everybody in my life said, "Yeah, right." And as the days went by, people kept saying, "You'll drink again." And the days went by and people said, "He'll drink again." And the days went by and now I've just passed my 5-year sobriety date, and I've never touched a drink since that day.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Congratulations. Yeah.
And I love that, because you just, in that moment, you made that decision. You made that emotional decision that, you know, what, I'm done. And you didn't need any, you know, AA or anything. Like, it's just you were that committed to it from that moment. Yeah. And it's like you had your own personal come to Jesus moment. Like, okay, I see where this has been. Yeah. I've lived this life. I'm now done and I'm ready to move forward. And that's a great segue for ultimately the second half we're going to get into, because now that you've made that decision, okay, I'm done. You still have been living as a person who's been in pain, who has had coping mechanisms that were unhealthy, that was doing drugs and drinking and all that to get through life. Now it's like, I'm sure that's who you thought you were, but now it's like, oh, I got to go forward. And I have to make changes. And just if you can give some insight, what that journey was like for you now that you made that decision to go forward and change.
Yeah, that's a really astute observation. Of course, when you live that kind of life, the life of substance abuse, you are ultimately covering your depression and covering the root of your trauma or the root causes of your trauma by distraction. That's the whole point of alcoholism and addiction. People call it a disease. I would, in a way, I would disagree with some of the classification of it, because then we're focusing on the symptoms, I do not believe is the way to treat alcohol or substance addiction or any form of addiction whatsoever. They are merely destructive symptoms covering up something significantly deeper. And I have this conversation all the time because obviously Alcoholics and Addicts reach out to me these days. So and she just agreed to be a sponsor for somebody this week. And they will gladly talk a lot of times. It's all about the symptoms. This is causing problems and that's causing problems. And, you know, my partner did this and I'm... Okay. I'm hearing it, but that's let's get to the base. What really has happened to you? Excuse me. So having had 42 years living a life that looked like that. Yeah. Suddenly, I had no toolkit. I had no devices or modalities or methods or practices to turn to cope with this. And I just did it pragmatically, is the short answer, Joe. In this, so my first year of sobriety, I spent a lot of it still in London, which was actually incredibly hard. My partner was still using, my friends were still using. So I would be the guy, you know, in the bar drinking the lemonade or the alcohol-free beer. But then when the cocaine came out, the energy changed completely, which is hilarious now, you know, having been able to observe that, because I was usually the guy handing out the cocaine. So I would then disappear, you know, stage left and leave everybody to have the calamitous night that was likely on the cards. But I started to meditate as my body got cleaner. And my mind became clearer, because ultimately, you know, we talk about being depressed all the time. Well, we don't all the time, but people say, I'm depressed. And one of the first things I say is, what are you consuming? Are you consuming alcohol? Well, yeah, that's a depressant. You know, are you consuming these foods? Yeah, also depressants. Are you moving? Are you doing any exercise? Are you doing any, are you going to the gym? Are you running? Are you going to do yoga? No, right. Well, that's also a depressant. So doctors aren't telling people this stuff, which, you know, all due respect to doctors. I appreciate the world over. We have a healthcare system that is struggling to cope with. You know, we can talk about that another time. But
yes, we agree. We have a sickness care system.
We do, exactly. It's not preventative at all, is it? And so I started to pick up these modalities, and of course, the more my body and mind cleansed, and I was working with these practices, the more incredible I felt. I was literally rising, and my consciousness was rising, my energy, my vibration, as I later discovered. What's a vibration? Yeah. you couldn't have talked to me about anything particularly spiritual back in those days. I was an agnostic, an atheist agnostic. But as this work continued, I began to see myself and those around me and our connection and our connection to the planet and nature in a completely different and more in a state of heightened awareness. I suppose that's the better way to put it. All of that said, I was still under quite a lot of pressure with this ongoing criminal thing. Excuse me, which eventually curtailed to nothingness, but there was a lot of pressure there, I was beginning to feel very, very miserable still in my workplace and in London and, you know, with my company, and I suspect there was a chance I could have used again at that point for sure, but then everything changed. My whole worldview changed when I was introduced to the very potent psychedelic plant medicine, otherwise known as ayahuasca. It's safe to say, after working with that medicine, and please note, I use the word medicine, not drug.
Right.
Which we can dive into if you like. It's safe to say, having worked with that medicine, my entire world, in fact, my other world view changed forever.
No, I love that. I've never done it, but yeah. I do have friends and colleagues who have done it. And again, and you talk about this in the book, it's, you don't just go down to the local corner and ask, you know, for the local ayahuasca dealer. Like, it's got to be in a controlled environment with someone who's an expert who understands and has the right plant medicines. So, because I think ultimately it's about getting the ego, as you talk about in the book, and we talk about getting the ego out of the way, right, connecting to that true divine self, listening to it, mm-hmm, allowing it to guide you so you can connect more to who you are and why you're here. And I think that's a great segue for going forward, because, you know, what we're seeing, and thank you so much for sharing your story, because I want people to understand, like, wow, look at what this man went through and look at how at peace he is. Yeah. And he's in a place now where he's done a complete 360. And now he's at a place where, if I can do it all this shit I've been through, then you know what? You can do it too. And here's some of the things I've learned. And I love that you talk about it in the book, because it doesn't come off as patriarchal, like, you know, I'm the one with all the answers. It's like, hey, you know what? Like you say, I'm a man on the mend, right? I've been through my journey. I've learned some things, and I just want to share that with you to make a difference in the world. So this first part is great.
I just can't wait to dive into the rest and what you call the anatomy of happy.
Yeah.
I think everybody's going to love that and resonate with it.
Right. Because it's like, you know, as we said, if you can go from this journey to now at a place where I think I figured out what the real components of happiness are, and I'm using those and I feel pretty good. And that's what you want to share. So that's what we're going to get into the second part. So this was awesome. I can't wait to start the second part.
Look forward to it.
All right.